this water bowl. Is this on?
Yeah, you know, I wasn't sure you were gonna start. So, that's okay. Let's see. That's okay. It's on now. Yeah, it's on. That's okay.
So all right.
So we'll just run.
So
it from now.
Okay. So let's use this water bowl. So because the impermanence of this bowl is hidden object. Okay. You only use your thinking, conceptual thought, when the object is hidden from your direct experience. But in our daily life, we tend to analyze for the direct manifest object, hidden object. That creates the cycle of suffering. So now let's say this ball is impermanent because this is product of this is produced, or this is a product of cause and condition. So everything, whatever something is product of cause and condition, is necessarily impermanent. Like car, like ball, cup ball, cup or plates. So the example needs to be relevant to your own culture. That's why I didn't use other analogies. Hopefully you own a car and car decays and car breaks down, you bought another car. And so that is your direct experience of car being impermanent. So I'm using that example to infer that this ball itself is an impermanent because it is produced. Okay. Now, so let's say now, because it is produced, therefore this is impermanent. So I got that understanding, that realization, and that is called inferential knowledge, which is the opposite of direct perception or opposite of non-conceptual awareness. So now I understood that this is impermanent. So now that's the time we need to stop. We stop, and now next step is, now you take a different level of meditation. Remember, meditation in Tibetan means getting familiar. So you have an intellectual understanding that this is impermanence. And now to integrate that in a deeper level of your consciousness, to experience directly. So now you either see this object, and then first you engage with what is called analytical meditation. And so you briefly go through this syllogistic format that I just did, and then you actually rest your mind on the impermanence of this ball. Short session to long session. Okay, so if we do that many times. Now, whatever teachings you receive, whatever teachings you read, it is really important to refer to the five paths, although the last path is the actual result, but it is called path, so five paths. So right now, what we are doing is the first path, or the first stages, or first level of accumulation and level of application. So during these two stages, we are actually practicing through our conceptual mind, actually. Okay? Our conceptual mind actually proved, understood that this is impermanent. So now we are actually first engaging with our conceptual mind that it understands this is impermanent. And then we actually rest our mind on that understanding again, again. And then through that process, next time you see this ball and you instantly feels the impermanence of this. I'm giving just ball as example, but this relates to ourself. So the whole purpose is to put ourselves as the object of analysis. But this is too much, too close. So first we have to use these outside objects. So let's say next time we get up morning or we go somewhere and instantly this direct experience, realization comes, the impermanence of our life. So there will be grosser level of getting sick, decaying, and death, and the subtle level of impermanence that every second, every minute, we constantly change. Constantly change like this, but we do not see the subtle changes. Those subtle changes are hidden object. Therefore, we need logical, analytical mind. Okay, this gross, if this breaks down, that will be direct experience. Okay, now, I also mentioned to you that what I'm sharing is Buddhist epistemological model mind. That means very important question, how we know things. How do we know that I exist? How do I know the reality of phenomena? Okay. How do I know that I need food today? Or I need sleep. Okay. So the question is, how do we know? And for that answer, then the whole Buddhist epistemological model, the theory of knowledge. Okay. So basically, there are three valid ways of knowing. Although there are more than three, but can be summarized into three. And these three are related to what I have shared so far. Let's say in order in terms of a practitioner, not in order as developmental process. So as a practitioner, the first sequence is knowing through analysis. And that is called analytical knowledge, or we also call it inferential knowledge. And I notice you're having fun there. Okay. Key one. So the second knowledge is called direct knowledge, and that is same as non-conceptual awareness. Okay. Now there's another one, third one, that is reliable sources. Okay. Knowing through reliable sources. So three ways of knowing, through analytical mind, that is conceptual thought, and then through direct perception or direct knowledge, which is non-conceptual awareness. And the third reliable sources, way of knowing, of reliable sources, is the third one. Okay. Now, why do you think we have these three ways of knowing? Any thoughts? Why do we have these three?
Because we are human.
Yes, we are human. That's true. That is true.
Dog can't.
Huh?
Dog can't do the inference.
Say again.
Dogs.
Dog
cannot infer.
Oh, cannot infer. Okay, all right. Okay.
But also, people have different ideas about almost everything. I mean, different people have different ideas about the same thing.
Okay.
So you have to have some way to sort it out.
Sort it out. Two ways.
Well, there's three ways that you can get.
Or
you
more.
Have to have some way. To
or many ways, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Any other? Yes.
No, I just had a question about what makes a reliable source.
Yes.
Yeah.
This is going to come. So, here is the reason. The reason is there are three objects. If there's only one object, that we may usually assume. And that's one of the main topics for today. When we perceive things, we usually may assume just one object. Maybe it is lay people's perspective. Maybe it is not a philosopher's understanding. Okay. So Buddhist philosophy explains three objects. Therefore, there are three ways of knowing, or three knowledges, or three minds, or three wisdoms. The object for the analytical mind or conceptual mind is called a hidden object. Okay, hidden object. So, like, for example, not the water, but the deep level of this ball that is hidden to your eye consciousness. And so you need to use your sixth mental consciousness, which includes the conceptual thought. Okay. Now, the second object, as I mentioned earlier, is called a manifest object. So for manifest object, then direct perception, direct experience, non-conceptual awareness. Okay. Now we have another object. Can you guess? Why do we need a reliable sources that we cannot understand through analytical nor direct experience? But we need to depend on some reliable sources. What that object might be?
Unmanifested.
Manifest.
Unmanifested.
Oh, okay. Out of manifest.
Not manifest.
Yes. It is called totally hidden object, or excessively hidden object. Okay, so we need to know these objects. I think this is very useful for our daily life, as well as for clinical purposes. So if you feel maybe clinical depression or anxiety, it is not good idea to focus on the extremely hidden objects when during the crisis situation. And I can tell you this through my clinical setting experience, that individuals reach to the crisis level, like extreme crisis level, maximum 10, and then individual is trying to analyze excessively hidden objects of long, long time events happen, and then analyzing why it did happen, how that happened, and that is actually source of the cycle of samsara. So the example of extremely or thoroughly hidden object are rebirth or subtle understanding of karma, past lives. Those are considered as extremely hidden object. Therefore, we cannot infer through our analytical knowledge. And although there might be some exceptions, but I am very doubtful to directly experience the past life and the future life at this present moment. But if someone does, then it shifts the object. So excessively hidden object becomes manifest object. Okay, so it shifts. Okay. Now it is called a reliable sources. That is like based on individual's writing, individual's instruction, individual's experience, that is reliable. That is reliable. For example, in Buddhist setting, maybe direct teaching of Buddha, Ganguru or Tenguru. Tenguru written by scholars. And especially Tenguru, the commentary of the original teaching, is highly analyzed and highly examined through meditative process. And so those information can be considered as reliable sources. Okay. So this is not a different what Buddhist is explaining. In the West, your reliable sources are peer-reviewed journal articles. But I see one kind of obstacles. The obstacle is that there's so much emphasis on the critical thinking and analytical process. It almost sounds like once critical thinking and analytical knowledge is the most reliable, most valid. And so when I teach my class, I would usually say, let's take our understanding, this critical thinking, analytical thinking, a little bit beyond. And let's say, examine through direct experience and observe its consistencies and reliability. Let's test by ourselves. See what the peer-reviewed journal article says is consistent or valid to my own direct experience. So if it is confirmed, if it is validated, then third-person research is consistent with one's direct experience or first-person-based research or first-person-based account. Okay. So usually we, so that means what someone says is true, what I experience is not true. That's not fair, right? We talk about equalities, all kinds of equalities, but we have given up our own direct experience, direct knowledge as kind of invalid. And that is the biggest loss. So now on, if we implement what I'm sharing with you, is to really appreciate and engage and treat our direct experience as valid. Okay. So if we do that, then you are getting one of the benefits of this talk. Okay. So any question came up? Any comments?
It is a past life, the reincarnation truth.
You are always interested, right? Past life what?
Do you have a direct experience on the experience in their past lives?
There are some individuals. There are some exceptional cases who are able to remember. I have not met. That doesn't mean anything.
Oh.
But His Holiness Dalai Lama is highly interested in meeting those individuals, and he has met individuals who now have two parents, this life's parent and as well as the previous life parents. So this one person has double parents. In India, actually, this is a real story. So there will be cases.
There are some Theravada Buddhists. They say that in a deep meditation, you can recall your past life.
That is what I hear in the literature, in the teachings. Yes, it will say that. And I will present you why it is also possible. I am not completely... How it is possible is not only Theravada, but through Mahayana Bodhisattva or Vajrayana. So when we engage with Shamatha meditation type that requires very, very refined concentration. And that refined concentration really helps to go to very deep, deep level of consciousness. Then one can actually able to understand about the past lives. So there are cases, and if someone has refined concentration, shamatha meditation, one can also has very, very clear mind to the extent one may able to see things directly, and that is called clairvoyance?
Clairvoyance.
Yeah. Yes. Is that important for you? To have a clairvoyance?
Clairvoyance is when your mind leave your body, float around, and be able to look around, is it? Look at yourself.
In this context, meaning that you are able to see your past lives and others' past lives.
In general, we use clairvoyance to mean like reading somebody's mind. I know what this person is thinking.
that also includes. Yes, that is also includes that. Okay. So there are literatures that I have seen it. Okay. Any other questions? So far, yes.
Well, it's not so much a question, but
yeah.
I would like your comment on something I recently read about. Really, it's about how people hold on to their histories and their knowledge through the time of history.
Mm-hmm.
Say, for example, let's use, since we're here, Tibetan history, teachings that have come through Tibet, Tibetan people, and is now coming out to other people, that it's important for people to be able to tell the story of their own history, so that the writing, for example, Tibetans have a strong history of writing, that then the arguing, say, the not the arguing, but you know, the defending a position, that Tibetan style of debate.
Right, debate, yes, yes.
That learning to debate the points that are brought forth by a teacher, such to study, to read, to listen, to study, to read.
Right.
So I'm thinking, well, no wonder it's been really hard on American Indian people, because we had no writing.
I see.
So we had no writing, so no teaching that taught how to logically argue or put forth a point of view based on a mind, based on being able to think in the cognitive way that writing kind of conditions the mind.
Right.
So I'm asking myself, is it because is this emphasis on logic and debate and all this, is it because it can be taught more easily because of writing and such than what you're saying, experiential? Because who can teach that, really?
Right.
You just have, there's experience that people can put other people into a situation where they might experience, but there's no guarantee of any comprehension.
Right.
So I'm just I'm just asking about the non-conceptual, dependent on experience.
Yes.
Highly personal.
Right.
You don't know what, how to. This
like,
person.
Like an individual, right?
Yeah. Would
individual
be able to
knowledge.
Teach me
yes.
What she knows.
Right.
Based on experience,
okay.
So she would have to depend on
teaching
with the writing and talking and debating and such.
Right.
So I just want a point of view on that.
Yes. So I think what you share, first of all, I want to share, direct experience based knowledge and wisdom. Are part of the reliable sources, way of knowing it, and so there are Tibetan, there is a Tibetan word called a damga. Damga is individual who learned teaching through analytical, through direct experience, and now it becomes like an individual empirical knowledge. And it is not necessarily common to the original teaching or the commentaries. This is like individual private understanding that is not necessarily common with others. And that is, that all the Lojong practice are considered as this category called Damga. And I translate that as empirical wisdom. Now going back to language and those are, so language helps. And language, of course, also involves conceptual thoughts. So if I share a Tibetan experience, now Tibetan language, as His Holiness frequently observe and mention is that Tibetan language becomes almost like a Buddhist language, especially individual scholars, practitioners who want to learn Buddhism more holistically than Tibetan language includes Theravadin, Mahayana Bodhisattva, and Vajrayana. So now Tibetan language actually is considered as important language for Buddhist studies. But what I want to share with you is one of the benefits of Tibetan language is because there is a common Tibetan language that really unites all the Tibetans. And so if there is no language, then groups remain very, very individual, and there is no, although there's activities that might have common, but linguistically there is no common, so then may remain separate, and there is a higher chance of not surviving, I guess. Even current situation in Tibet, because Tibetan language is common in all Tibetan areas, even the four regions that are already annexed in Chinese states also speak Tibetan language in common Amdo. And so now, these days, Tibetan identity and culture and this unity is still preserved mainly because of Tibetan language. And language includes history, culture, and teachings. And so even they are separated, but they are kept as a Tibetan. So that is what I want to share.
So it creates solidarity,
yes,
instead of knowledge and,
yes,
culture
right,
fragment.
Right, right.
You pass on fragments and
right,
more fragments. And
right.
Yeah.
Yes. Actually, His Holiness Dalai Lama is recommending places where there is no language,
mm-hmm,
to create a language, and that will bring and preserve their identity and their language, their history, if there is a written form, and it is also functioning, usable. Okay, and
going back to reliable sources.
Yes.
I read that the Mahayana,
mm-hmm,
and I don't know whether this is all true or not, but I saw some, kind of a list of what Mahayana believes are important to be a reliable source.
Mm-hmm.
And in this list was, what's believed to be Buddhist teachings.
Mm-hmm.
And commentaries.
Mm-hmm.
But also what was interesting is one of these was that like a commentary or what is thought to be a Buddhist teaching must fit with what we already know. So if we, I think what what it was saying, what the meaning is if we think there's a teaching that Buddha actually made, but it doesn't really fit with the whole,
mm-hmm,
then it's probably not something to be relied on.
Okay.
And so then when you said that about Lojong, it made me wonder about Lojong, because if I understand what you said, you were saying that's an individual, experience, not necessarily something that relies on Buddha's teachings.
Maybe I need to explain that. So Lojong practice is based on original teachings and commentaries, but there are parts that direct experience meaning, instead of explaining very, very detailed instructions, and Lojong's come up very, very few words that opens so much. And so that kind of teaching method actually comes from direct experience. And sometimes you may not necessarily find the same explanation in the original teachings, some kind of like a personal realization, personal understanding, that is still rooted, but that realization may not necessarily directly related to the original teachings. Now, let me share you what constitutes reliable sources. Okay, so if something is reliable sources, it is really same as Western research. So in Buddhist teaching, if something is reliable sources, then one must be reliable and consistent. Reliable meaning that, let's say, concept of impermanence is reliable concept teaching because it is validated through analytical knowledge as well as direct experience. So therefore, now the concept and the practice of impermanence becomes valid source, reliable sources. And the concept of impermanence is also reliable sources because it is very, very consistent from the insects to human beings to the cars. And so therefore, that is very, very reliable sources. So in our debate, we will also use analytical. Direct experience will be used separately, but we'll use the reliable sources. So we will quote and cite these reliable sources. But also during the debate, it is not always necessarily acceptable quoting, citing reliable sources. That is the excitement and the fun part of debate, is that the defender could actually refuse to accept, and that is totally fine. So in a debate setting, if some teacher says this, and one says, my mother says that too. So like in the West, you say, he said, she said.
Yeah.
And so reliable sources are not dependable during the debate. It is totally free to support through some reasons and so, but anyhow.
And because of that, the validity of it exists.
Yes, yes. Okay. Yes.
So
yes.
Of the three sort ways of knowing,
yes,
you know, is one way considered superior to others?
Yes. 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 The most superior is direct experience. Okay. Not only that. Actually, I do not have my PowerPoint, but otherwise, all the purpose of analysis is to get to the direct perception, direct knowledge. Okay, the whole purpose. And so, like for example, there is a four reliance. So first, you hear the common quotation that the Buddha's teaching is not for faith or devotion, but for the reasons analyzed and then acceptable. You accept. If it is not supported by reason, then you don't accept. Then the question is, how do you analyze? And this brings four reliance. The first relying is, not to rely on the person, but the person's word. That is just beginning ways of relying on information. So you don't accept face value, as you mentioned, but rely on what the person says. So you analyze what the person's word and how do they relate each other, any contradictions, any inconsistencies, or just saying statement and there's no reasons, no examples. So therefore, not accepting what he said or she said, but rely on the actual word, what is expressed, okay, either verbal form or written. And then the next to that is, do not rely on word, but the meaning. So this means, do not rely on the word, W-O-R-D, that's what I cannot pronounce sometimes. Do not rely on the word, but rely on the meaning. Okay, that's a very profound. You see the shifts. Sometimes we, if we hear this one teaching that says, do not rely on the person but the word, and then we just spend our time just literally taking that and just live with the word and now no in-depth understanding what the word means, okay? So therefore, now we are shifting this another methods of analyzing. So do not rely on the word, but the meaning. Okay? And the next, now you can guess. Do not rely on the meaning. Do not rely on the provisional, but rely on the definitive meaning. So within the meaning, when you hear some meaning, you understand some meaning. And if someone says some meaning, this is the meaning of this, then you really need to analyze. If someone says, life is good, that life is good company, and you hear the life is good, and you buy their t-shirts and their hat, that means now you are believing their provisional. Actually, life is good is a provisional, definitely. Now, the way how we distinguish between provisional and definitive is provisional meanings are mentioned for the purpose of something, and it has a contradiction to the reality. Okay? So let's say if someone is a little bit down, and then person says, sometimes it may make really person very upset and feeling that not understood and not listened if someone says, life is good. But let's say a person is a little bit lighter, and then if you say, life is good, life is great.
It's all good.
For the purpose to bring some hope, for the purpose to bring some other perspective. But life is good has itself has contradiction. The minute we say life is good, it implies that life is also bad. But life is bad is totally ignored. So definite meaning is meaning that is actually literally acceptable, doesn't have contradictions, and that definite meaning doesn't have any purpose to lift up someone's sad situation or anxious situation. For example, all conditions are impermanent. That is definite meaning. So if someone says life is permanent, that would be definitely provisional. But if you hear life is impermanent, that is a definitive meaning. Okay, so my main point is this last one. So it took a little time. I guess process is more important than the destination, right? So the last one is, do not rely on conceptual thought. I'm translating it slightly different. So do not rely on conceptual thought, but rely on non-conceptual experience and awareness. Okay, so this last one is the highest one. So do not rely on, usually it will say, do not rely on consciousness, but rely on wisdom or transcendental wisdom. But what it really means is, do not rely on conceptual thought, but rely on non-conceptual awareness. So this shows that after all, direct experience, not only direct experience, there are valid direct experience and invalid direct experience. In other words, valid non-conceptual awareness and invalid non-conceptual awareness. So we have to know the differences. So the valid non-conceptual awareness, meaning whatever the person is experiencing is relevant to the reality. Okay, so for example, if I bring back impermanence, so you directly experience that our body is impermanent. Now I space out a little bit. Help me. What am I saying?
I don't know. What are you saying?
So making the distinction between valid, cognitive, and non-valid.
Right. So I remember now. Thank you. So if I directly experience that my body constantly changes every second, every minute, and therefore, my body is impermanent. Now that is valid non-conceptual awareness. because it is relevant to the reality, the objective reality. Now here's another invalid one.
Okay.
Invalid non-conceptual awareness is person directly experience that my body is permanent. I'm just, in case there is some, I don't know. Now that would be like invalid non-conceptual awareness.
Like teenagers.
Teenagers?
No.
Oh, I see.
Could we call that delusional?
Oh, delusion, yes. Now,
but
delusion experience is example of invalid non-conceptual awareness.
Thank you.
Delusion is a direct experience, but it is not related to the reality. Like, for example, last time I shared from my experience, someone has a delusion that there's a snake inside the body.
Mm-hmm.
And these delusions are so strong, and so strong meaning well supported by reasons. That's why do not quarrel, do not argue to say this is delusional. And so when I ask, this person says, look at there. It is moving. These veins or pulse are moving. See there? There's no, otherwise, how come there is a movement in my body? So how can I, so there is no debate. So that one is directly experience, but it is really not consistent to the reality. Okay? Now let me share you some classical examples of invalid, non-conceptual awareness. When you are in car, in a fast car, and you see the trees are going, that's called an object. That is object-related, invalid, non-conceptual awareness, or direct experience. Okay, and then there's a like one pen like this, with the 4th of July light. And if I move like this, you see circle, but you don't, actually this is not a circle. So those are classical example of invalid direct experience. Okay, now I see some hands. Yes?
For being able to determine whether our experience, a non-conceptual experience, is valid or invalid, then that's when we look to these reliable sources.
Yes, we look reliable sources, and especially if there's a book that you find has already analyzed, has already experienced, and so then it is really useless sometimes, especially for practitioners, useless to analyze and to search for other direct experience. You just accept that reliable sources. Remember? That's how I bought TV with Bob.
That's right.
Yeah. But the real question is whether do these methods really work for discovering the deeply hidden.
Yes.
The deeply hidden things.
Yes.
Like rebirth.
Right, right.
So that's really the key question,
right.
It seems to me.
Right.
It isn't clear to me that these methods work.
Right, right. So here is what might work.
Okay.
What might work is whatever is going to happen in the future has to come from present. So not to worry too much about what my rebirth may look like or what next life, and we simply live this life, this whatever remaining life, and that actually can be more helpful than trying to know about the past and about the future. Yes.
I'm trouble with the book thing.
Yes.
Okay.
Reliable sources.
Yeah, reliable sources in a book.
Yes.
Okay. So, you know, I'm really interested in UFOs.
Yes.
I'm reading all this stuff.
Yes.
But is it really reliable? I mean, is Eric von Däniken really reliable?
So now, so now, if you find a person who witness, are you talking about aliens?
Aliens. Aliens,
yeah.
Let's say.
Yeah,
yeah.
UFOs.
Yeah.
So then, I will really rely on the person who witnessed and saw not only one time, but consistently, and has interactions, maybe has pictures. then I may just easily accept that. Sometimes it's important to analyze, but it's also equally important to just directly experience what is there.
The Buddha said that he experienced past lives.
Yes.
But I have never heard the Buddha say he experienced the future lives. But did he say that? I don't know.
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think he ever said that, did he?
Well.
No, it's not in his sutta or anything.
I don't know. I don't know, future life. What do you think?
I think future is unknown.
Are you interested in future life?
Yes, I am. But I don't think I can know. I mean, you just make it. What you do determines what the future is.
Right. So again, it's important to ask ourselves: is it really important for me to know my future life, or is it important for me to live with my current life? And so we just need to decide what is our value.
So it seems to me that despite these methods, you know, and the three ways of knowing and the four reliances, it still comes back to you individually have to decide.
Yes, that's true.
What's reliable.
That's true.
What you believe.
That is true. That is true.
Okay.
Right. So individually, we are important. We make the decision. You get, Tibetans have a saying, you ask for others and you make the decisions. So something like that. Yes.
I'm not sure how I want to phrase this, but there's a concept or a saying in this culture about get out of your head,
mm-hmm.
where all the analytical, conceptual
mm-hmm.
thinking goes, and get into your heart.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, isn't that place of knowing
yes.
somewhere, maybe
mm-hmm.
it's in our head or where, we don't know where that is,
right.
but isn't that a sense
yes.
of non-conceptual awareness that
yes.
we sort of think it comes from our heart, but it's
right.
not definable or there's no proof of what we feel that we know for sure?
So clear what I lost a little bit.
So did I.
Say again. So I understand
getting out of head. Get out of your head.
That's another, that's more like a physical way of saying get out of head and what?
But if you get
in touch with the heart or something?
Yeah, of a deep sense of knowing
right.
something for
right.
sure. And you don't know why you believe that or how you came to that sense of knowing.
Right.
And there's no way to prove it.
Oh, I see. So here is the, so direct experience itself doesn't need a proof. But if we want, then we may make reference to those reliable sources.
Yeah, I guess it is a direct experience, is
yes.
how you come to be at
yes.
that place.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
So direct experience, valid direct experience itself is a valid already.
Okay.
But if we want further additional, then we can refer to the resources. Yes.
So with the question about get out of your head,
yes.
feel more with your heart,
yes.
and stuff like, I have a personality that when some people start telling me how they feel,
how
and everything's how they feel,
yes.
and it's like, shut up. Because it's like, it's just your feeling, you're just, emotions are like just bubbling out everywhere. How
mm-hmm.
are you making a distinction? How do you even know when
mm-hmm.
you feel it? Well,
mm-hmm.
I feel this, or I, you know, oh, how come you believe that? Well, I felt the such as a, and,
mm-hmm.
okay, so, one time at a medicine, we were at a big ceremony, and my mom was already like 80 or something, and we're sitting there, and she's going, watching, we drove her to this event, we were watching, she said, okay, she's going.